Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on that zero emission future that we all hope for. Every week I'm joined by one of the wonderful EV Cafe team, and I've got the delightful Saz, or Sarah Sloman, to those that don't know her so well. Saz, welcome.
Yeah, today you're stuck with me.
It's a delight and a pleasure to be stuck with you, that's for sure. But better than that, even better, we get to talk to some of the innovators, pioneers, and collaborators of our industry. And we really have an innovator and a pioneer here today in Russ Peterson, founder of the amazing vehicle manufacturer Munro. Russ, welcome.
Hey, good to be here. And this is my first ever podcast, so you're popping my podcast cherry.
Wow, we love to pop a cherry.
We've had a few firsts, I would say. There have been a few firsts. We'll look after you, don't worry.
Brilliant.
Absolutely. So, Russ, listen, tell us a little bit, first of all, about Munro, because Munro is, from my perspective, is a super exciting product, and I would love to know where the name came from as well. But tell us about the Munro.
Okay, cool. So Munro is an electric vehicle manufacturer based in Scotland, and we're a startup. So we've been going since around 2019. And our mission is to help the dirtiest industries in the world decarbonize. So we focus primarily on industries such as forestry, agriculture, mining, and construction, where traditionally they struggle to decarbonize their operations, but they do have a fleet of aging 4x4s, which are, as we know, the most polluting vehicles on the road. So we are developing specialist vehicles to replace the traditional 4x4s. So we started in 2019, and our original plan was to convert old Land Rovers and things like that to electric. And the more we went on with that project, the more we realized that actually it's not necessarily the electrification part that is the most difficult part, but the productization. So we were finding that a lot of the feedback from early potential customers and people we spoke to were that they were not happy with their combustion engine vehicles anyway. So this gave us a really good opportunity to then think about, okay, can we develop an entirely new product that focuses on specialist 4x4 fleet, and then not only solve the electrification problem, but also solve product problems with the vehicle.
And listen, from what I've seen and experienced, I feel one of the very privileged few to have driven this vehicle in anger in the wilds of Cumbria? Yeah, it would be Cumbria, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
in the
Cumbria.
Wilds of Cumbria in the Lake District. Just working on my geography there. But so the name Munro. Now, I kind of think I know where the name Munro comes from. You probably actually told me. But anyway, tell me where that name comes from.
It's funny because a lot of people get confused with Munro, like Marilyn Monroe. And it's not Marilyn Monroe. It's Munro, which is a Scottish word that basically means a mountain. There's 260-odd Munros in Scotland. And there's an activity called Munro bagging, which is where you try and climb as many Munros as possible. I'm a bit afraid to say I've only climbed one, which is a bit disappointing, seeing as I've lived here nearly 10 years. So I've climbed one, but basically the name came from, we wanted to really put a picture in people's minds of where our product could go and what the capabilities of the product were. And it seemed fitting that, considering we're a Scottish-based startup, that we pick a Scottish word, and Munro made absolute sense, because it's that's ultimately where we'd love to see our vehicles in things like mountain rescue and forestry up in the Scottish Highlands and in the Munros.
Yeah, fantastic. Oh, yeah. So I was right.
You were right, although it's spelt differently though, isn't it? Munro's Munro is usually with an E. Is it 900 meters or something has to be the minimum to be considered a Munro. I think I've only done one as well, if that makes you feel any better. It was Goat Fell on Arran fact checkers amongst us can take my crown away from my proud one. But no, I knew it would be something like that. And I'm so jealous. In fact, my notes yesterday got as far as I'm jealous, I want one, which I don't really think is very befitting for the Cotswolds. But I do love the application you've done. Now, this is all about building out obsolescence. I believe this is about making sure that in 50 years' time, all you have to do is swap out maybe the battery or another component part. Now, I find that completely fascinating from a sort of carbon intensity perspective. But just last week on the EV Cafe News, we were talking about how expensive that can be, translating that technology to like a normal van. So I wondered if you were able, without giving away all your commercial sensitivities, of course, but thinking about how we can make this product, this productization, appealing compared to an internal combustion equivalent. How does that work?
Yeah, this is really interesting, actually, because it's what we deal with day in, day out. And the way we have approached this and approached the market is we've approached this like machinery. So all of our customers invest in capital assets like diggers, bulldozers, forestry machines, combine harvesters. And these things are not they're not treated like automotive. When businesses buy these pieces of machinery, they take a long-term view on it. It's a high capital outlay. They want to make sure that it lasts as long as possible to get their return on investment, and they're not looking to dispose of this within a couple of years. So actually, when you step back and look at the broader context in these industries, the automotive and the trucks and cars are an outlier. They're not the normal way of purchasing assets. So what we are trying to do is get fleet managers in these heavy industries to just treat less like any other digger or bulldozer or any other piece of machinery that they're investing in, and say, look, let's look at this over a 7 to 10 year period rather than a 3 to 5 year period. And this does two things. One is it obviously drastically helps the total cost of ownership, but the other thing it does is seriously reduce the carbon emissions. You know, the majority of emissions from light vehicles are from manufacturing. So the longer we can make them last, the better. You know, the less carbon emissions they'll have over their lifetime.
This is just genius. And actually, I'm thinking back to another friend of the EV Cafe that we've got, Lorna McAteer from National Grid. She has converted, what, over 1,000? You know, she's the fleet manager there. So she and the team have converted over 1,000 now vehicles to pure EV. But they haven't quite cracked the towing, the 4x4s, those really niche vehicles that have to go completely off-road and do something far more challenging. Is part of the business plan here to offer trials and chances to you? I know you're doing CDIS funding. This may be premature, but describe to me how you're going to see this rolling out.
Okay, so we're already undertaking a bunch of live trials with customers. So we've had a couple of private one-on-one trials with customers, and we've also had demonstration days where people can come and see the product for themselves. And then the next thing we're doing, which is quite unusual for a car manufacturer, is we're giving early adopters the chance to own a prototype. So rather than us having to manage a large fleet of prototypes, we have a select number of customers that can help us with data and feedback on the product. And that means that we can work in partnership to make sure that the product market fit is right, and just get the vehicles out there as soon as possible to learn more. So, you know, industries like mining and agriculture, forestry, like the really, really hardcore ones, that's where we're starting. But we are starting to move towards construction. We've got a couple of interesting construction customers and utility customers as well that are partaking in these trials.
And that's what's been really interesting to see, is that your approach has been very much put the vehicle out there in its raw form. You know, we know that there's polish to come and bits to add and different things. And I think that attitude, that way of working, seems to be the most effective, because you've built up a really strong order bank from what we can tell. You know, and obviously that's what's reported in the press, a wonderful pipeline of, if my memory serves, 68 million, which is okay. That's nice for an investor coming along going, okay, you got an order book of 68 million, but also you're proving things as you go. What fundamental things have changed since that initial sort of first product to the market? What things have added on as from customer feedback and from learnings that you've had from the field?
The first thing is I should probably explain why we take this approach, and it's because my background is software, and in software, and the best way to get your product out there is just to get it out there as soon as possible, to get it in front of people, to get live data and feedback straight away. It's lean software development. You have a feedback loop. You understand customer insights as soon as possible. That informs the rolling development of the product, rather than doing big monolithic releases. So that's why we take such a different approach, is because I just look at this like we're developing a piece of software. So what have we learned? Well, the first time we showed a vehicle to customers was back in September 2021, and that vehicle was something that myself and the co-founder of the business, Ross, made ourselves in a shed in Glasgow, along with our who's now joined us as head of engineering, Peter. And so it was self-built, a very, very basic, didn't even have any paint, so it hadn't been painted. It was just raw aluminium and steel, so warts and all, and enabled us to, right from the start, look at the balance between on and off-road ability. So we had a bunch of theories about the type of customer that we wanted and the type of customer that would buy something like a Munro. But what we didn't really understand was if the market was particularly ready for it, and also if we had the right idea about the balance between on and off-road. So I think what's changed over the last couple of years developing the product is we've definitely started looking more on-road handling, which is, I think it's easier to come from extreme off-road and make it softer to drive on the road than the other way around of trying to make a road car go off-road. So I think we took the right approach, but I think we probably scared off a lot of customers in the early days because they got in something that was like incredibly brutal off-road and just had more capability than they could ever need, but didn't quite have the refinement on the road. So a bit noisy, or some vibration or something like that. And I think that's the blessing and curse of showing people your product early, is you're going to get really good insights. It's going to inform the development, so you don't waste any money developing the wrong features. But also, you run the risk of scaring people off that just don't understand. They look at it and they think, oh, this is the finished product. It's no good, and I won't buy it. So we're lucky that the majority of people can see through that and see that it's a prototype. But yeah, it's been an interesting journey, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, that is an incredibly interesting journey, and I love that idea of taking that feedback in, because I know, from early feedback from some of the larger fleets, things that we don't often think about, things like traction control, ESP, and other safety systems like airbags and things like that, in order for them to be able to invest or to purchase the product, they need those things there. So it's an incredible learning journey. Saz, I know that you've got a thought.
I did. I'm listening to this with wide eyes, actually. It's all fantastic to hear. I would say 10 years ago, we had a huge challenge in government to convert 25% of all vehicles. Now, the biggest, hardest one there was the MOD. So having sort of the utility vehicles. Now, I know agriculture, forestry, and mining, now that's a big crack. That's a big nut to crack. But what you've got here is a big budget. Obviously, the MOD are able to invest. Like you say, I love what you said about people don't look at these vehicles in the same way as other vehicles. That's my learning point from today. You're quite right. Just wonder how we can get you in front of them. You've done quarries. What about Salisbury Plain? What about getting down there to show them the capability? And considering, of course, I assume that the inverter is capable of solar charging, because that's one of the biggest problems with the electric vehicles. It's all fleet. So that includes the ones in the desert right now. So they're looking at battery storage and solar to support their electric fleet. Seems like the least of their worries, but it's a real problem they've got.
Yeah, definitely. I think I have to be careful how much I can say, but
Brilliant. That's enough.
but from what I've learned, I'll just say this much. From what I've learned about the MOD's way of thinking, they are pretty advanced. I think they're, although they are at the moment taking a relatively slow approach to the market, it's very careful, and they have very clear ideas about what they see the future of their light fleet. So incredibly sophisticated customer, incredibly advanced and really, really forward thinking about how to really make the most of an asset like this, rather than just seeing it as a car that can move people. Obviously, the vehicle has the ability to power things. It has the ability to move more than just people, but goods as well, and has the ability to go into places where you typically wouldn't want to take a vehicle for emissions reasons, both noise and pollution. So, yeah, there's some interesting conversations. We're talking to a couple of potential partners for some projects in defense, just generally. But yeah, you're quite right. I don't typically lead with defense because it traditionally has been a bit divisive. I think it's with the war in Ukraine, it's become a little bit easier to talk about defense. People kind of understand a little bit more about what defense means versus versus just fighting some crazy war. But yeah, it's difficult one to talk to. Difficult one to talk about. So I don't generally lead with it. But it's a very, very interesting market, and actually, alongside mining, it's probably the best fit for this vehicle.
It certainly strikes me as that when you think about the product development side of things, they'd have a niche set of requirements that you could work with them on with that prototype level. Even if you combined that with futuristic autonomy, imagine if a vehicle like yours could be used to seek out, you know, landmines or things to preserve life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's super exciting. I mean, my son works in the REMI, the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, and of course, you know, he's just dealing with the day-to-day stuff, but you're absolutely right, the term of use of these vehicles is incredible. And when you look at what I think it's MAN is their main truck supplier these days, and some of those vehicles are just so developed beyond anything that we'd ever see on the road. But that's part of that tender process, isn't it? You know, that you have to develop something that meets that need. Incredible. But do you know what, Russ? In all of this, the most curious thing for me is that you mentioned your word background. Now, as I looked back and I looked across everything that you've done, that nothing points to making a vehicle. It looks like you've been fairly entrepreneurial from the early days. I'm not sure, other than working in Sainsbury's, you've ever had a proper job, as it were, in the sense of, I mean, I know you've had lots of proper jobs, but what was the inspiration? What's that journey been from, you know, a job in Sainsbury's all the way up through? And I couldn't find any evidence of like university and all of that sort of stuff. So that's really exciting for me because I've never been to university either, unless you have been, of course. But anyway, so I'm interested. I'm curious as to all of that.
Yeah, thanks for invalidating all the proper jobs I've ever had. That's great. you're quite right. I've not approached this industry from a traditional point of view. And I think that, you know, that also breeds a huge amount of imposter syndrome, which is a whole other discussion. But a farmer's boy. Grew up in agriculture, grew up in the countryside. My grandfather was a mechanic, and I've always been interested in anything mechanized, anything that moves, anything that's got gears, or not necessarily engines. Like people always say, oh, anything that's got an engine, but I think that I've been detached from that side of it. I've just been really interested in machinery. I was told you can't be a farmer. Farmers don't make any money. Go out and get a proper job. So, but also told you're not going to uni because we can't afford it. So it was, you know, early 2000s, and the thing that was really, you know, really taking off was software. You know, software development. And it was still quite niche to be a software developer at that time. It's a little bit different now. I think the marketplace has become a little bit crowded. There's a lot of 16-week courses to become a software developer. Back then, there wasn't. You went to college and then university, or you didn't become a software developer. And the people that were in those software development positions were typically already quite older people with very fixed mindsets. And there was this real opportunity to disrupt. So I taught myself how to develop software, primarily web software, so databases, coding, functional things rather than design. I've never been much of a designer, but yeah, very, very functional, very much engineering. And I managed to land a job, a proper job, I have, you know, with a little company just outside of Cambridge. And they were a tiny little company, a tiny little outfit. There was just four software developers in the team. And they did software for mobile phone operators. And they were called On Mobile, and you would never have heard of them. And before that, they were called Phone Stars. And they're just, you would never know, but I can guarantee that all of us would have used the software that I wrote. So we were writing back-end software for all of the major mobile networks around the world, Vodafone, Three, Orange, T-Mobile, both in the UK, Ireland, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, India. We did some really, really early connected mobile stuff in India for smartphones. And this was around the time of iPhone being launched as well. So we saw a big transition from feature phones to smartphones. So then we were developing infrastructure around smartphones. Every mobile phone operator thought they were going to have their own app store. So we were building app stores like Apple's App Store, but then obviously Apple's App Store took over and Google Play took over. So we did well. We went from a team of a few people in software through to being acquired by a multinational. It was crazy to think the value that me coding at 2 a.m. As a 18-year-old got sold for. You know, they just, and I think that's partly also like what sparked a bit of entrepreneurialism in me, is I saw that what I thought was particularly crap work just got multi-million pound price tag on it overnight and got sold. I was reading the marketing, the PR from the acquisition, and they were talking about all these like amazing things we'd built. And it was just like, no, I just did that in an afternoon. And suddenly that's something that's in a press release going around the world as like, you know, cutting edge technology. And I think it opened my eyes. So it led to a 15-year career in software, but you're right, it's primarily off the radar. And that's because I wanted to work for myself. So I had the opportunity to go and work for any of those big mobile networks. I'd been in the offices of all of them, and I had contacts in all of them. But I decided, you know what, I'd like to work on my own products. I'd like to firstly consult and help other people. And the other thing is I stupidly thought that I could have a big tech idea and have my own, you know, next big app or whatever. So did that for quite a few years, crushed and burned a few times, and wound up starting a software agency in Edinburgh called Bad Dinosaur. And it was myself and one other person in co-working. And there was another software agency that was in the same building, and they had just taken on a massive contract with Deliveroo. And so they were getting people coming to them and wanted to build stuff, but they didn't have the resource. So it was this kind of like, oh, I know someone in co-working that maybe could deal with that. And so we got past a bunch of leads, and one of them was this really big piece of software for education. So I said, you know what, let's give this a go. Let's pretend to be a big company. Let's pitch for it and let's win it. And we won it. So then we were like, well, we actually have to go and build that company now. So for 3 years, we built our company up in Edinburgh from two people to a team of 20. 2.5 to 3 million turnover in 3 years, and then the pandemic happened. So I decided I've done enough software for a bit, and I want to try something else. And I'd been playing around with Land Rovers, and we had the idea for Munro, and I was like, you know what, I've got the time, I've got the money, you know, let's give this a go.
I love this. I love it.
This is so good.
It's just such it's so inspiring, and you know, I'm glad I said never had a proper job, because it's quite clear that you, from the very beginning, you have been exceptional and out with a proper job, a normal job. And I'm guessing you began life in what was affectionately termed as Silicon Fen.
Silicon Fen, I love that. Oh, that's fantastic. I've never heard that before. Silicon
Fen. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's brilliant. It's, yeah.
So the Fen's just outside Cambridge.
Big up the Fenlanders. Yeah, a Silicon Fen. Brilliant. Yeah, it was a Silicon Fen. Yeah, I used to ride my motorbike through the Fens every morning. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. And because I the only reason I know that is just before 2000, I spent, I don't know, probably 9 horrible hard months in IT recruitment. And it was all for the Y2K projects, you know, the pre-2000 projects of, and so much was happening in Silicon Fen. But the interesting bit was that Bluetooth was just coming to the fore just before that time. So around that same time, they were looking for engineers around that sort of thing. So I'm guessing, you know, part of, and now look, but anyway, Sarah's got a question, so I'm going to hand to Sarah, but I've got something I'm really curious about, but go for it, Sarah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, what I love about these podcasts is I didn't know that about you either, Paul. So, you know, Silicon Fens unite. I also, what I wrote down whilst you were speaking, I only wrote one word because I was staring at you whilst you spoke, but I wrote resilience. It is incredible to hear that you were told no from an early date. You can't be a farmer, you can't do this, you can't. And also, there's no money for you to go to the university. And you just went, ugh, I'll do it anyway, and coded something when you were 18 in your bedroom at 2 a.m. And I just think there's heart in that sentiment. I remember lots of people at the moment are sort of in this stage of a booming industry, and a lot of us aren't sleeping at night. A lot of us are waking up with thoughts and clever plans that they quickly write down and try to get back to sleep. And they feel almost embarrassed or worried about that phase that they're in. And actually, you've proven yet again to me here that those things that happen early in the morning, that's creative productivity right there. Something about being able to unlock during that phase of sleep a new idea, a new concept, and see it through. Just absolutely hats off from me. And what I really wanted to know was, I hope that they're still around. What do your parents say now?
They're very proud. They're very proud. And you know, the resilience bit, I just I need to be completely truthful, is I did actually end up going back into agriculture. So I, when I had my my various software consulting businesses, I grew up on a farm. I grew up with tractors, and I wanted to go and play tractors, and I had a bunch of cash, and I was like, you know what, I'd really like to own a tractor. So I bought a tractor, and I did agricultural contracting for about 3 years, and I didn't make a penny. It was horrendous. It was like the worst financial decision I'd ever made. And if I'd put all of that money into anything else, I would be probably a multi-millionaire right now. But I put that money into buying farm machinery, and it was just awful. It was just like, no farmer wants to sign a contract, which is fair enough, but everything's done on a handshake. They drop you at a moment's notice. And then farm machinery is just horrendous secondhand. So you just lose money on everything you do. And it's, you know, you don't have a social life. It's 65 hours a week minimum. It's just, so I was like, I think my parents were right to say don't go into agriculture. So so then that's how I ended up back in software. But
you probably needed that tractor phase.
Yeah, I needed to get out of my system.
But it set you up nicely for being in a startup where, you know, I'm sure 65 hours is a quiet week, at its height, where you're just kind of, you know, 12-hour days, 15-hour days, and possibly, you know, a few sleepless nights along the way. But, of course, you know, as much as software does help you kind of come up with the mindset, that agile mentality, kind of, you know, the development loops, as you termed. But I noticed also that you decided to kind of help yourself in 2019 or something, an electric vehicle course that you went, an e-learning course, would that be right? Mm-hmm. That has set up effectively your ability to now come and do what you're doing. And this blows me away. I love the approach that you take to this kind of this development. Talk me through what inspired that moment of saying, right, I want to build a vehicle.
Yeah, so we were myself and Ross, the co-founder of the business, we were up in the Highlands doing a bit of camping, and we were just like, it just, I don't know quite how the conversation came apart. So I was I was doing off-roading at the weekends, and I had a few off-roaders, 4x4s, and I had a little garage in Glasgow that I used to repair them and work with friends and stuff like that. So we'd gone up in one of my off-roaders into the Highlands, and we saw these EV chargers, and it just sparked this conversation. And Ross had a Renault Zoe at the time, and he was like, you know, if we could have a Renault Zoe but off-road. And it just kick-started. And then we had to cut our camping trip short because it was thunder and lightning, and it was just like horrendous weather as it is in Scotland most of the time. But we were driving back down to Glasgow, and it was just like the whole way just talking about how it makes so much sense. Just, you know, it's they're heavy, but they're slow moving, they're geared low, and it was just like all these things that just started. And we basically productized what we wanted to do there and then on the spot of like, this is how we can do it. And we, you know, we were dead set on converting a Land Rover, and we bought a Land Rover. And that was part of the reason why I did the course, is because Ross and I had learned a lot about electric vehicles and their parts, but we just wanted to make sure we were safe. So we did the Institute of Mechanical Engineering EV course to make sure that we weren't going to blow ourselves up, and then just went for it. I mean,
She
there was
did.
loads
Of
of, you know,
course, she did.
we were reading online and looking at videos at the time of like people that were doing conversions of electric vehicles, and it was very crude. This was like just as this was just on the dawn of like Zero EV, who now Felton, you know, it was right at the dawn of people actually doing these conversions. And at the time when we came up with the concept, like nobody had converted a Land Rover. The only person that had got anywhere close was this guy called Don in Australia, who has got a Land Rover Lightweight. And there was this guy on YouTube called Damien Maguire, and there was this video of him with a BMW, and he'd put a DC motor in it, and he had one Tesla module on the passenger seat, and he was touching he had the end of the cable, and he was touching the end of the cable to the module to make it drive backwards and forwards. So that was the benchmark. We were like, you know what? If these guys can do it and not blow themselves up, then maybe we can give this a go.
Interesting, you mentioned Zero EV and what it's now known as Felton. Fantastic team, expanding all the time, successful with some investment, but mostly sort of organic growth. And the reason that flipped is because they spotted that there's a better business model to show other people how to do the same thing, to sell kits essentially. And then that is where their swell came from. And I know they've got huge plans, so the best of luck to them. And that story, when you're saying about you're off-roading at weekends, I was a little disappointed because I thought you were about to say that you somehow beefed up a Zoe and started taking that off-road as well, which would have been amazing, amazing to see. And then just as you said, we decided to do a mechanical engineering course. Of course you did. Everything you've said today is just so inspiring. I'm just sat here with my eyebrows up. Those who are watching online, you'll see I keep raising my eyebrows. Like, how is this true? Come on, this can't be true. But it is, and that's what you've done. And what's really interesting is at the start of the interview, we laughed and joked about imposter syndrome. And I just want to know, if are you human? Do you still suffer considering everything that you've done? Does imposter syndrome ever cross your path?
Oh, yeah, and it's why I mentioned it earlier, was that, you know, it's quite right that Paul is like, hey, you've got no qualification or experience in automotive. Like, what are you doing running a car company? And we get that all the time. And we've hired like a lot of great minds into the business who do have the credentials of being in automotive, which is great, and it helps us get credibility. But I've never seen myself limited by background or ability at any point in time. I'll just go and learn things. I love to learn, and we'll just go and do it. And I think to come back to software, it was the big thing that I realized from the start of my career in software to running the software agency is I just how easy it was in the early thousands to actually make a big difference in software. And now with a commoditization of software, it's much harder, much harder. And there's so much regulation, there's so much awareness, there's ethics, there's all kinds of things which are there for a really good reason, and it's great. But it, you know, I think of some of the things we did in the early days that really it created massive strides, and I worry that we won't be able to do that again, because the industry's evolved so much. And what I've really enjoyed about what we're doing here at Monroe is we've been able to make massive strides, and it's and we've had to create an environment which it's safe to do so, and it's acceptable to do so, but we've been able to really push the boundaries of automotive. And I think that one of the only reasons we've been able to do that is because neither Ross or I or Peter, our head of engineering, have an automotive background. We all have our respective skill sets, but so yeah, it's frustrating when you're kind of judged at face value sometimes. And also the imposter syndrome is very much internalized as well. It's not necessarily things people say to you or comments they make, but also trusting your gut feel. And often you, like, through the course of development of the vehicle, we've made decisions of various aspects of the prototypes, and we've said, I don't think that's the right way of doing it, but that's the way we know how to do it. And it turns out that either that decision we've made is really, really close to what's in automotive or potentially better. So it's been an interesting journey, and we're definitely getting more and more confidence every day that we build cars and learn. But it's a tough gig for sure.
But as I reflect back and just look at everything that you've done, it just kind of it seems that you were born to do this kind of thing, to push a boundary, to take things. And I think, I of course I'm going to say this, aren't I? But I think university and this kind of structured learning is hugely overrated in terms of what does it churn out. I mean, people doing degrees in really random things and then going off and doing something completely separate. It maybe teaches us to learn, possibly gives us some structure around research and learning and things like that. But it seems that your natural hunger to learn, your curiosity from an early age around the mechanization that you saw around you, then the software processes, all of these things have brought you to this point where you're now able to take another boundary and just kind of smash through it and do something amazing. Where do you see Monroe going? Where's the finish for this? Or is there a finish? Is this the start of something that will go across the world and just continue to grow and evolve, which I can see as a real possibility? But what's your thoughts about it?
Yeah, just to touch on the education piece, like I think learning is a mindset, and I think once you can get your brain in gear and you create that like positive feedback loop of you learn something and then you do it and then you realize you can do it, then it's very addictive. And I think that's always been the way, and it's Ross and I have a very, very similar mindset of just try it, just do it, none of the whataboutery, just let's just give it a go and see. And if we fail, then we learn. You learn from something not working out as well. So I don't know. I'd actually disagree in some ways that university probably doesn't teach you a learning mindset. It puts you in a structure, but doesn't necessarily give you the correct psychological skills to become addicted to actually learning things and to know your own abilities. It just teaches you to remember stuff. It teaches you, and it's very difficult because I haven't been to uni. I have been to college. I studied agriculture for a year. I did a 2-year course in 1 year, which was a bit stupid, but I did a 2-year agricultural course. And my favorite part about that was the workshop stuff, believe it or not. So I learned how to weld and do all the skills there. But what I see a lot of in people that we hire and people I've hired in the past from university is that they're really good at resourcing things. So they're really good at finding out information and really good at exams. They're really good at filling out information, but they don't have a hunger to learn and to try things. And I see sometimes I see some of my early self in these people of like. I used to want to just code things and then not test it, and that's an interesting sign of maturity as well. Is in engineering and whether it's software or hardware, do you want to test what you've just made? Because if you make it and then you don't test it, you're scared of it. So I think that's a big differentiator. When I'm interviewing people or when I'm looking in the workshop, like and working with some of our engineers, it's like if they've tested what they've just made, then I've got a lot of respect. And if they haven't, then I'm like, you're scared of that, you know? And that means that you don't fully understand it if you're scared of it. Because if you're scared of it going wrong, or if you're scared of it being wrong, then you obviously don't feel completely confident in the first place. So anyway, where do I see Monroe going? Right from the start, we wanted to make a really concrete business. So it's a really difficult time for electric vehicle startups, because every week there's some sort of bad news about an EV startup that's either had to massively pivot, or they've laid thousands of people off, or they've gone bust, or they've been merged with someone else, never to be seen again. And it's again, prior to Monroe, I worked with probably in the region of 100 different software startups in 3 years. And what my business was building MVPs, so minimum viable products and concepts for software businesses. And nearly all of them had investment, and nearly all of them are gone. And I think, and not because of the software, I just want to say, not because of the software we developed, but because, it's a tough gig, right? And if you overpromise and you shoot for the stars, this whole thing of like shoot for the stars and land on the moon, how about we just build some really good concrete businesses that are self-sufficient as soon as possible, that create jobs, create prosperity? How about we just focus on building stable businesses instead of shooting for the stars? And I think that's, Ross and I, very similar backgrounds, very similar mindset here. Let's just try and stand on our own 2 feet. It doesn't matter, if we build 5 vehicles or 50 vehicles or 5,000 vehicles or 5 million. What matters is that we create something that's going to stand the test of time. So what do I see the future of Monroe? Well, we're really open-minded, and thankfully our investors are as well. And they're kind of with us on this one of like, look, don't fall into the trap of traditional startups, but let's just try and make some real impact here. And if we can make some impact, both from an economical sense and from environmental, then we've ultimately ticked the box. So yeah, we see Monroe, we'll gradually grow, we'll gradually build up our production capacity, we'll gradually break the market for the kind of vehicles that we want to replace and to put in, and we'll also move to adjacent products. So bigger machines, smaller machines, more agricultural machines maybe, who knows? But we want to remain creative, we want to remain quite independent and stand on our own 2 feet.
And just
Fantastic.
being, continue to be addicted to that learning and development. At the moment, there's two models, I think. Who knows how many there'll be by the end of next year or the year after. I love your sort of approach, this sort of scalable, ethical, sustainable business. In sustainable, not just in the terms of environmental, but sustainable as in assuring people that they will have a job in 2 years' time. It's not an unstable market to
Exactly.
be in. It's something that we see as the future. This is one of my favorite podcasts we've ever done. I absolutely have every respect for you. I work in software company as well, and there's a lot of this mindset about quick, 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 quick. We've got to get done as quickly as possible, and I see that as a very unsustainable, scalable route to market. And the testing, yes, test, test, test. It's almost seen as a sort of, well, if we get found out that that bit doesn't work, well, yeah, you do, and then you fix it, and then you become their best friend because you've stopped them from having a terrible experience, like consumer experience, customer experience. In your case, the market you're working in, as you say, it is niche, it is tough. It's going to be the last to crack in the EV space. But with your ingenuity, the other thing I think you'll find funny is I thought when you were saying Ross, you were referring to yourself, Russ, in the third person. Yet Russ and I, Russ and I. And it's like, I didn't realize there was two of you with the same similar sounding name. Fantastic. Just clearing that for any other listener who might not have got the difference.
It's such a issue that I've actually gone back to my formal name, which is Russell, because otherwise when we introduce ourselves as Russ and Ross, people are just like Ross, 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 who? And then we've got another Ross on the team as well, Ross Compton. So now I sign all my emails off and I introduce myself, I'm Russell, because otherwise, exactly that, there's mad confusion. And it was funny
Brilliant.
For the first like couple of months. And then after that, I'm like, yes, Ross, 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 yes. So.
Oh gosh. Oh, do you know what? And I think, Sarah's right to say being inspired. This has been such, I mean, I genuinely could spend the next few hours talking to you about all of this, because I feel very fortunate to have seen and been close to some of the startups that have either been and gone, been and maybe going, and seen how tough, particularly I think cash flow, one of the biggest challenges, having the money to just kind of pay your staff, because your staff are important, pay for product or bits of product, batteries, hugely expensive, and we know, from Volta at the moment, they're, whilst they are in administration, they've not gone yet. That's great news, but they have got a big, big problem with the battery. So, and that's because cash flow is a problem over there. This is a really tough market, and it's testament in my mind to the strength that you've built into the Munro model and everything that you've brought in terms of your learning to this point and enabling you to kind of just kind of plow through with a completely unique vehicle. I love it because it answers so many questions for the industry. I'm all about commercial vehicles, and this vehicle is everything commercial, but it's got its passenger element as well. It kind of seems to cover everything, and it just feels that, yeah, just keep that momentum, keep it moving. And it's kind of like the synergy or the simile with the vehicle and the business, kind of just go anywhere, keep going, just kind of getting over every obstacle that's in your way. I'm conscious we don't want to go on for hours, but I feel like there's another podcast here. I really do, just about the use cases, how you're developing all of the technology that's coming and all of that good stuff. But
we've not even really talked about the product, have we?
I know, I don't think that. We did at the start.
Well, it's all on the website. Just go look it up.
Go check out on the website. But I think, do you know what? We focused on the product with Arrival, right? We focused on the product with Volta. We focused on the product many times with businesses that have come to market, but have we looked at the strength of the foundation and the quality of the minds and the people, the methodologies? And I think that's what will make your business real, and that's what will get you over the line. That's what your investors have invested in, right? I reckon.
Yeah.
And that's what future investors will see as well.
At the end of the day, we look at this like any other manufacturing business. Like, the product is obviously key, and how we market and how we develop that product and how we make sure that the product meets customers' needs is obviously number one priority. But outside of that, this is a pretty boring and unsexy manufacturing pipeline. Raw materials come in one end, electronics come in one end, and then a vehicle comes out the other end, and the vehicle has to be right. And I think the way we're different, or the way we've approached this differently to some of the other startups, is we've focused on manufacturing from day one. This has been, the volume isn't being important. We're not developing a vehicle for scale. We are building one vehicle at a time. Let's make sure we can do it repeatedly. We have control over the manufacturing pipeline. Just developing it. And I say to quite a lot of our customers that say, like, oh, how are you going to scale up? It's like, well, we're not just developing the vehicle. We're also developing the production line and the manufacturing processes, and all that stuff is boring and people don't really, we had some politicians here, and they just want to look at the cool truck. They're not interested in all the dirty machinery and all the jigs and fixtures and processes and raw materials. But that's all the stuff that gets me just as excited as the product, is actually the execution. And ultimately, that's what will allow Munro to succeed, is the ability to execute. If, as I saw time and time again with software, idea not really worth anything. Execution is where the value is.
100%.
We will watch with great interest, because I think the 3.5 ton mark is a really interesting market that we can all watch. And there's clearly a use case for it. We teased and joked about the fact that we didn't really talk about the product. Well, we did at the start, but we're more interested in you. That's why we've got you on the show. We could have watched your corporate video and come and seen the vehicle itself. But please do, everybody, have a look at it, because it will make you really want one. It even gives the price on there, which actually a lot of people are scared to do. So, you know, I've got every faith, and I have truly been inspired. I've taken notes for myself that I'll be carrying forward. I'm just really grateful for your time, and it was really nice to meet you.
Brilliant. No, thank you so much for having me. It's been fantastic, and my cherry is well and truly popped.
I really wish you'd stop saying that, though. It's really odd.
But Russ, I want to give a bit of nice news for Sarah, because I think it's really important. You can go on the website and order one.
Yeah, I know. I just kind of need the 75 grand, but yeah.
But that's really important, everybody. The Munro is now available to order. You can go on the website and order your very own amazing off-road beast that can tow stuff. So, whether it be fleet or whether it be adventure or agriculture, mining the hard to decarbonize areas, or you're just passionate about, you know, replacing, and let's not be too harsh on the dirty old Land Rover, but because it was clearly a bit of an inspiration, but this is Land Rover with an upgrade. And listen, I will also point you to the video that I myself did in the vehicle going up I don't know what degree slope. It was very, very steep. So head over to Electric Van Man on YouTube. It's there. And you'll see the Munro in action, because it is a quite incredible beast. But for now, Russ, you genuinely have been an inspiration today. I feel very energized for my day, very encouraged by your passion, your ingenuity, your innovative mindset, that passion, that drive, that curiosity. And I really thank you for your time today. A lot of people will get a lot out of listening to this today. So thanks ever so much.
Brilliant. No, thanks so much for having me. And if you don't mind, I'll just shout out that if you want to be part of our journey and you want to be involved in Munro and see it grow, and please look us up on the Seeders platform, because we're currently doing a crowdfund.
Wow. There you go. So head over to the Seeders platform. We will put a link in there. So Russ, if you can provide us with a link to do that, we'll put a link in the comments, so you'll be able to see that for yourself and invest in this business and play a part in it. And that would be really exciting. So Russ, thanks so much. Munro, thank you for doing what you do as a business. And until next time, everybody, head over to theevcafe.org to see all of our content, all of the other podcasts. Follow Munro both on LinkedIn, get on their website, connect up with Russ as well, or Russell, Russell Peterson, and Ross, and everybody else called Ross or Russell in the business. and ultimately, have a great day, everybody. Thanks, Sass. Thanks, Russ. Great job.
Thank you.